And just for your information before we begin, apparently that a few people were asking for the reference to the Agni Sutta, which I read out yesterday. And the Agni Sutta title, I think that was a translation, I think, but he might get upset at me about this, as from Venerable Ajahn Sujata, and I thought that's really cool to call something ugly. The real sutta is the unattractive instead of the ugly. It's pretty much means the same thing. But anyway, it's in the Anguttara Nikaya 4, and it's the Sutta 163. The 4s, 163, for those of you who want to do more investigation into the practice of the ugly. Okie dokie. So we've still got another few seconds to go. Tomorrow, I put these sutras together a bit of a rush, and so it looks like we need another sutta for tomorrow. So the sutta we're going to read out tomorrow is called the Surprise Sutta. To see which one it is, but I think I'm pretty much going to take a couple of short suttas from the Citta Samyutta, and that is going to be printed out by Leha in a few minutes. I'm not sure when she'll have them ready, but anyway, they'll be there for you afterwards. That's excellent. But today, instead of doing the Agni Sutta, today we're going to be reciting the Delightful Sutta. So we've had the good, the ugly, we need the one in the middle, which is, what's that?
Who knows?
Good, bad, who knows? I could say the bad, the good, bad and the ugly. But anyway, that's only messing around. I think we're all supposed to be here now anyway. It is now 3 o'clock, so we may actually begin. We're still missing one of the nuns, she's a bit late. Okay. No trouble at all. Just get the camera ready. Oh, there you are. Excellent. Very good. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. The Delightful Discourse, and this is from the Digha Nikaya, that's why they're always a little bit long. Thus have I heard, once the Buddha was staying amongst the Sakyans at the school building in a mango grove belonging to the Vedanya family. At that time, the Nigantha Nataputta had just died at Pawa. It was a strange occurrence that there was two major religions began at the same time in the same area, the Jains under Nigantha Nataputta and the Buddhists, which was just so close by. And many historians of the understanding, I think it's quite possible that at that time the Jains were even more than the Buddhists at first. But then later on the Buddhists became more numerous. At that time, the Nigantha Nataputta had just died at Pawa, and at his death, the Nigantas were split into two parties, quarreling and disputing. Fighting and attacking each other, this is the usual way, with wordy warfare. You don't understand this doctrine and discipline? I do. How could you understand this doctrine and discipline? Your way is all wrong. Mine is right. I am consistent. You aren't. You said last what you should have said first. And you said first what you should have said last. What took you so long to think up this doctrine has been refuted. Your argument has been overthrown. You're defeated. Go on, save your doctrine. Get out of that if you can. You would have thought the Nagantas and Nataputta's disciples were bent on killing each other. They saw that their doctrine and discipline was so ill-proclaimed, so unedifyingly displayed, and so ineffectual in calming the passions, having been proclaimed by one not fully enlightened, and now with the support God, without an arbiter. Now, it's because of something like that that the monks, after the Buddha passed away, made sure that they all came together to collect as many of the teachings as possible, to give them some sort of authority, to have, you know, some sort of standard by which they wouldn't need to have all these stupid arguments. Now the novice Chunda, who has spent the rains at Pawa, the rains retreat, came to the Susamagama to see the Venerable Ananda. It's actually quite a long way from where the Sakya country is to where the Jains were. The Jains were around Rajaka area. It was quite a distance. Venerable Ananda, saluting him, he sat down to one side and said, "Sir, the Niganta Nataputta has just died at Pawa." And he related what had happened. The Venerable Ananda said, "Chunda, that is something that ought to be reported to the Blessed One. Let us go and tell him." "Very good, sir," said Chunda. So they went to the Lord Buddha and told him. He said, "Chunda, here is a doctrine and discipline that is ill-proclaimed, unedifyingly displayed and ineffectual in calming the passions, because its proclaimer was not fully enlightened." Such being the case, and tomorrow in the suttas which we're going to read out tomorrow, there's a nice little instructive example of that. Not wanting to put down anybody, but just what actually other people understood in India at the time. He was not fully enlightened. "Such being the case, Chunda, a disciple cannot live according to that doctrine and maintain proper conduct, nor live by it, but deviates from it. To him one might say, 'Friend, this is what you have received, and you have your opportunity. Your teacher is not fully enlightened. You cannot live according to that doctrine, but deviate from it.' In this case, Chunda, the teacher is to blame, the doctrine is to blame, but the pupil is praiseworthy, because he deviates from it. And if anyone were to say to that pupil, 'Come now, Reverend Sir, and practice according to the doctrine proclaimed and given out by your teacher,' then the one who urged this, the thing urged, and the one who so practiced would all gain much demerit. Why? Because the doctrine is ill proclaimed. But here, teacher, a teacher who is not fully enlightened, and a disciple lives according to that doctrine and conforms to it, doesn't deviate from it. One might say to him, 'Friend, what you have received is no good. Your opportunity is a poor one. Your teacher is not fully enlightened. His teaching is ill proclaimed.' But you continue to live according to it. In this case, the teacher, the doctrine, and the disciple are all to blame. And if anyone were to say, 'Well, Reverend Sir, by following that system, you will be successful,' the one who so recommended it, that which was recommended, and the one who, on hearing such recommendations, should make still greater efforts, would all gain much demerit. Why? Because the doctrine is ill proclaimed." But here now is a teacher who is fully enlightened. His doctrine is well proclaimed, edifyingly displayed, effectual in calming the passions because of that enlightened teacher. But the disciple does not live up to the doctrine, but deviates from it. In that case, one might say to him, 'Friend, you have failed. You have missed your opportunity. Your teacher is fully enlightened. His doctrine is well proclaimed. But you do not follow it, you deviate from it. In this case, the teacher and the doctrine are praiseworthy, but the pupil is to blame. And if anyone were to say, 'Well, Reverend Sir, you should follow that teaching proclaimed by your teacher,' then the one who urged this, that which was urged, and the one who so practiced would all gain much merit. Why? Because the doctrine is well proclaimed. But now, Chunda, here is a teacher who is fully enlightened, his doctrine is well proclaimed, and the disciple, having taken it up, follows it, practicing it properly and keeping to it. Someone might say to him, "Friend, what you have received is good. Here is your opportunity, and you are following the doctrine of your teacher. In this case, the teacher and the doctrine are praiseworthy, and the pupil is also praiseworthy. And if anyone were to say to such a disciple, 'Well, Reverend Sir, by following that system you will be successful,' then the one who thus commends it, and that which is commended, and the one who, on hearing such commendation, should make still greater efforts, would all gain much merit. Why? Because that is so when the doctrine and disciple are well proclaimed, edifyingly displayed, and effectual in calming the passions, because of the fully enlightened teacher and supreme being." So, this is just starting off that it is okay if you know you're pretty certain that someone is practicing a wrong way, to just ask them, to say that, you know, is that teaching calming the passions? Or are you getting more excited, more ill will, more craving, more wanting? So, you know, especially this is for those of, you know, not the monks and nuns, we've made a choice already, but for those who haven't made a choice yet, please be careful what particular path, what particular teacher, what particular teachings you follow. It's so easy to impress people for a while. And one of the most important things to do is, before you have any trust in the teacher, is actually to check them out first of all. See where they live. Hang around with them for a while and actually see what their behavior is like. Because otherwise, it's very simple sometimes to get inspired by a teacher, but then you find out was misbehaving, you know, when you didn't really know what they were up to. So because of that, it's great to be able to gain some trust just after many, many years. So when a teacher just comes into your midst very soon and looks very inspiring and teaches the Dhamma just very well, you think, you may think that, oh, this is wonderful, but just wait for a while, sometimes years, and see whether that is a really, really, really good teaching or whether there's something going on in the background. Any comments about that before I go ahead? Okay. Any comments from Mitaji?
Good to see you, Ajahn.
That's very nice. But now, Chunda, suppose a teacher has arisen in the world, an arahat, fully enlightened Buddha, and the doctrine is well proclaimed. It's effectual in calming the passions because of that teacher, but his disciples have not fully mastered that true Dhamma. The full purity of the holy life has not become clear and evident to them in the logic of the unfolding, that's Bhikkhu Bodhi, and has not been sufficiently grounded in among them, being still in the course of being well proclaimed among humans at the time the teacher's passing away from them. That way, Chunda, the teacher's death would be a sad thing for the disciples. Why, they would think, our teacher rose in the world for us, an arahat, fully enlightened Buddha, whose doctrine was well proclaimed. But we did not fully master the true Dhamma, as long as it was well proclaimed among humans. And now a teacher has passed away from among us. That way the teacher's death would be a sad thing for the disciples. But suppose a teacher has arisen in the world, and the disciples have fully mastered the true Dhamma. The full purity of the holy life has become clear and evident to them in the logic of its unfolding, and has been sufficiently grounded among them while being thus well proclaimed among humans by the time the teacher's passing from them. That way the teacher's death would not be a sad thing for his disciples. Why? They would think, our teacher rose in the world for us, and we have fully mastered the true Dhamma, while it was thus proclaimed among humans. And now our teacher has passed away from among us. That way the teacher's death would not be a sad thing for the disciples. That's important, that, you know, that if you do get into the role of teacher, make sure that people know what you're teaching, spread it around, and then when it's been well spread around, then you can die. It's fair enough, isn't it? Yes, you're nodding your head. Okay. Prachunda. If the holy life is so circumstanced that there is no teacher who is senior of long standing, long ordained, mature and advanced in seniority, then in such a case the holy life will be imperfect. But if such a teacher exists, then the holy life can be perfected in such a case. If in such a case there is such a senior teacher, but if there are no senior disciples among the monks who are experienced, trained, skilled, who have attained peace from bondage, who are able to proclaim the true Dhamma, able to refute any opposing doctrines that may arise by means of true Dhamma, and having done so, give a grounded exposition of Dhamma, then the holy life is not perfected. In such cases, if there are such senior teachers and such senior disciples, but there are no monks of middle standing with these qualities, or despite the presence of these, no junior monks with these qualities, no senior disciples amongst the bhikkhunis, no middle ranking junior bhikkhunis, no white robe lay followers, male or female, celibate or otherwise, or if the teaching does not prosper and flourish, is not widespread, widely known, proclaimed far and wide, or even if these conditions are fulfilled but has not gained the first place in public support, then the holy life is not perfected. If, however, all these conditions are fulfilled, then the holy life is perfected. Now, one of the things which I like about that statement is it's not just the teacher. It's just all the monks and nuns and lay people and lay supporters who are with that teacher. Make sure that they have some of these experiences, attainments or whatever. And if those occur, then the holy life has been well established, even perfected. So we don't follow ever one monk or one nun. We follow the tradition. We take refuge, as I often say, never in one teacher. We take refuge in the Sangha, in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And you say you do follow Ajahn Brahm? No, you don't follow Ajahn Brahm. You follow the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. Please always remember that, because otherwise we get into what becomes cults. Anyway, where's it going? Ah, thank you so much. Prachunda, I have now arisen in the world as an arahat, fully enlightened Buddha. The Dhamma is well proclaimed. My disciples are proficient in the true Dhamma. The full purity of the holy life has become clear and evident to them in the logic of its unfolding. But now I'm an aged teaching of long standing who went forth a long time ago, and my life is coming to its close. However, there are senior teachers amongst the monks who are experienced, trained, skilled, who have attained peace from bondage, able to proclaim the true Dhamma, able to refute by means of the Dhamma any opposing doctrines that may arise, and having done so, give a grounded exposition of Dhamma. There are middle-ranking monks who are disciplined and experienced. There are novices who are disciples. There are senior, middle-ranking, and novice nuns who are disciples. It doesn't mean actually seminaries here. It means just the young, junior. Because for the first 5 years, they call us navakas. So seminaries is what we usually translate as novices. But the first 5 years, you are a navaka. And the next 5 years, you are a majjhima, middle ranking. Yeah? Nuns. And after 10 years, you become what we call a tera. Has it met any terrors of Dhammasara? Be quiet, don't say anything. Actually, this weekend there were no terrors at Dhammasara. I suppose he's gone to Dhammaloka for this weekend.
About the other two?
Oh, the other two. Oh, that's Manisara. She's a terror, isn't she? Oh, yeah. That's right. Very good. Thank you. So he's still got two terrors. Terry, okay, yeah. And after 20 years as a monk or a nun, what are you called? Mahatera. Mahatera. And that's after 20 years. And after 30 years, what are you called?
Old.
Old. You know, well, you are called old, but you're called... No, I just made this up myself. After 30 years from Tera, Mahatera, Megatera. And after 30 years, when you're 40 years, you're called Gigatera. And after 50 years, you're Terra Terra. Or something like that. Have some fun with this. Anyway, where am I? I said, well, I know where I am. I'm this now 47 years. So I am over a Gigatera. So, you know, from 40 to 49, you're a Gigatera, so you have to play the part. A Giga. Giga. Okay, so you got it. But after 50 years, be careful, I'll be a Terra Terra. Now where was I? 16? Say?
16.
Among all the teachers existing in the world, Chunda, I see none who has attained to such a position of fame and following as I have. Of all the orders and groups in the world, I see none as famous and well followed as my Sangha of monks. If anyone would refer to any holy way of life as being fully successful and perfect, with nothing lacking and nothing superfluous, well proclaimed the perfection of its purity, it is this holy life that would be that they would be describing. It was Uddaka Ramaputta who used to say, "He sees but does not see." What is that seeing? What is that seeing one does not see? And the answer in those days was, you can see the blade of a well-sharpened razor, but not its edge. That is what he meant by saying he sees but does not see. He spoke in reference to a low, vulgar, worldly, ignoble thing of no spiritual significance, a mere razor. But if one were to use that expression properly, he sees but does not see, it would be like this. What he sees is a holy way of life which is fully successful and perfect, with nothing lacking and nothing superfluous, well proclaimed in the perfection of its purity. If he were to deduct anything from it, thinking this way it would be purer, he does not see it. And if he were to add anything to it, thinking this way it would be more complete, then he does not see it. That is the meaning of the saying, he sees but does not see. Therefore, Chunda, if anyone were to refer to any holy way of life as being fully successful and perfect, it is this holy life that they will be describing. So that's like this morning when I my glasses disappeared. I can see, but I couldn't see. They're being cleaned. Therefore, Chunda, all you to whom I have taught these truths that I have realized by super knowledge. By super knowledge is by this experience, really powerful, deep knowledge, because of the strength and credible power of the jhanas. I realize by super knowledge should come to, so all of you to whom I have taught these truths that I have realized by super knowledge should come together and recite them, setting meaning beside meaning and expression beside expression, without dissension, in order that this holy life may continue and be established for a long time, for the profit and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, and for the benefit, profit and happiness of devas and humans. What are the things that you should recite together? This is interesting because it's like a fundamental, important part of the teachings. They are the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four roads to power, the five spiritual faculties, the five mental powers, the seven efforts, that's wrong, the seven factors of enlightenment, and the Noble Eightfold Path. These are the things that you should recite together. And those are called the Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. And thus you must train yourself. Being assembled in harmony without dissension, if a fellow in the holy life quotes the Dhamma in the assembly, and if you think he has either misunderstood the sense or expressed it wrongly, you should neither applaud nor reject it, but should say to him, "Friend, If you mean such and such, you should put it either like this or like that. Which is more appropriate? Or if you say such and such, you mean either this or that. Which is more appropriate? If he replies, this meaning is better expressed like this than like that, or the sense of the expression is this rather than that, then his words should be neither rejected nor disparaged, but you should explain to him carefully the correct meaning and the expression. And I kind of like that, because instead of just arguing with him, that's wrong, that's not the right way of saying it, that's not the right meaning, we just investigate. Because sometimes that people just have slips of the tongue. Sometimes you speak fast and you say the wrong word. So just pause and just see if we can make sure that when we do meet together, we do recite suttas, that we make sure we get it reasonably right. Again, Chunda, if a fellow in the holy life quotes Dharma in the assembly, and if you think he has misunderstood the sense, though he's expressed it correctly, you should neither applaud nor reject it, but should say to him or her, "Friend, these words can mean either this or that. Which sense is more appropriate?" And if he replies they mean this, then his words should be neither rejected nor disparaged, but you should explain to him carefully the correct meaning. And similarly, if you think he has got the right meaning but expressed it wrongly, you should explain to him carefully the correct meaning expression. But, Chunda, if you think he has got the right meaning and expressed it correctly, you should say good, sadhu, and should applaud and congratulate him, saying, "We are lucky, we are most fortunate to find a new friend, a companion in the holy life who is so well versed in both the meaning and the expression." Now, Chunda, I do not teach you a Dhamma for restraining the corruptions that arise in the present life alone. I do not teach a Dhamma merely for the destruction in future lives, but one for their restraining in this life as well as for the destruction in the future lives. Accordingly, Chunda, let the robe I have allowed you be simply for warding off the cold, warding off the heat, warding off the touch of gadfly, mosquito, wind, sun, and creeping things, just so as to protect your modesty. Let the alms food I have allowed you just be enough for the support and maintenance of your body, for keeping it unimpaired, for the furtherance of the holy life, with the thought, "Thus I shall eliminate the former feeling of hunger without giving rise to a new one of overeating. In that way I shall live without fault and in comfort. Let the lodging I have allowed you be simply for warding off the cold, for warding off the heat, for warding off the touch of gadflies," you might say over here, bush flies, "mosquitoes, wind, sun, and creeping things, just for allaying the perils of the seasons and for the enjoyment of seclusion." So the little huts which we have as monks, always remember that they're supposed to be just for seclusion, not for secret meetings with your friends. "Let the provision of medicines and necessities for the treatment of sickness that I have allowed for you just be for warding off feelings of sickness that have arisen and for the maintenance of health." That's just a standard thing which often the monks, we recite that little passage. So we always remember why we are eating alms food, why we are using medicines if we need them, why we are staying in a hut. What's the purpose of a hut? Mostly it's for comfort and seclusion. And lastly, just, you know, why it is that monks live solitary. We have one person per hut. Beautiful thing. And then lastly, just our robes. Our robes are kept simple. It's one of the reasons why. I am a senior monk, and I've got lots of responsibilities, but my robe, does it really stand out from other people's robes? And the robes all look the same. Your robe, my robe, nuns' robes, pretty different colours sometimes, but the quality is the same. I do not order my robes from Gucci. Actually, does Gucci make robes? I don't know what I'm talking about a lot of the time. You don't get these things from high-end retailers in the top end of town. These are just ordinary ropes. And what happens when the ropes get cut? Or they've got a tear in them? What do the monks do? A patch on them, yes. You got any patches on yours?
Oh, loads.
Yeah, let's have a look at your patches. This is my model today. I can't see any. Where's it going? Oh, there you go. Yay, well done. Now, if you had your dress or your suit and had a cut in it, would you put a patch on it and go to work in this nice three-piece suit with a patch here and a patch there? But we do that because this is our tradition. And many times people see that and say, wow, what a good idea, because you're not wasting things as much. Anyway, and also we use things like robes not just for those purposes. This one over here, this is also my, bed sheet when I go to sleep at night. This is bed sheet on top. And it's also, I use it for many other things. When I was traveled a lot, I think it was the case once of one of those aircraft that got shot down over Ukraine or something. And they said, well, Ajahn Brahm, aren't you afraid of flying that much? You know, sooner or later, there's conflicts, and you go over those areas of conflicts to get to Europe to teach. I said, no, I'm not afraid at all, because I've got my own parachute. My rope, it's very big, the rope. It's about 3 meters by 2 meters, and maybe less here, a bit there. But that's a nice big area for a parachute. So if I get shot down, I just go out and unfold the rope and just float down. Wouldn't that be a good idea? But they said, well, sometimes you might land in some very dangerous area like Iraq or Afghanistan. Then what are you going to do, Ajahn Brahm? I said, very easy. Because these ropes over here, I cut a little slit in here. And it'll be my burqa. So innovation. Okay. Now this is one of the main reasons why I read out this sutta today. This passage is here, coming next, from number 23. It may be, Chunda, that wanderers of other sects might say, the ascetics who follow the Sakyan, that's the Buddha, are addicted to a life of devotion to pleasure. If so, they should be asked, what kind of a life of devotion to pleasure, friend? For such a life can take many different forms. There are, Chunda, four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are low, vulgar, worldly, ignoble, and not conducive to welfare, not leading to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation. Disenchantment, I would prefer to say fading away. To tranquility, to realization, to enlightenment, to nirvana. What are they? Firstly, a foolish person takes pleasure and delight in killing living beings. People go hunting. Secondly, someone takes pleasure and delight in taking what is not given. You know, stealing. And sometimes, I remember seeing these in movies when I was young, they were stealing just for the excitement of stealing, not because they wanted the money. And thirdly, someone takes pleasure and delight in telling lies. Fourthly, someone gives themselves up to the indulgence and enjoyment of the pleasures of the five senses. These are the four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are low, vulgar, not leading to fading away to enlightenment and nirvana. And it may be that those of other sects might say, are the followers of the Sakyan, the Buddhists, given to these forms of pleasure seeking? They should be told no, for they would not be speaking correctly about you. They would be slandering you with false and untrue statements. That's not what Buddhist monks or Buddhist nuns, even Buddhist lay people, are really supposed to be doing, especially the Sangha of monks and nuns. Now, there are, Chunda, these four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are entirely conducive to fading away, to dispassion, cessation, tranquility, to realization, to enlightenment, to nirvana. They're supposed to be leading in the right direction. Especially, I mentioned earlier in another sutta, that middle one, to the tranquility, the peace. That's important, because there you can really find out, you know, your search for pleasure, your search for devotion to pleasure, is it devoted, is it going to lead to something good, or is it just going to lead to more trouble? What are they? What are these four kinds of life devoted to pleasure which are entirely conducive to the right things? Firstly, I think you all know what's coming up next. Firstly, a monk free from the five senses, free from unwholesome mental states, enters upon and abides in the first jhana, enters and remains in the second jhana, enters and remains in the third jhana, enters and remains in the fourth jhana. These are the four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are entirely conducive to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to tranquility, to realization, to enlightenment, to nirvana. So if wanderers from other sects should say that the followers of the Sakya and the Buddhist monks and nuns are addicted to these four forms of pleasure seeking, they should be told, yes, you've got it, right on. The Buddha never said those last two things, but I was just emphasizing the point. For they would be speaking correctly about you. They would not be slandering you with false or untrue statements. When I first read that the first time, I thought, wow! I mean, Buddhist monks and Buddhist nuns, according to the word of the Buddha, are devoted to four types of pleasure seeking. Weird, isn't it? We always think that monks and nuns, we're ascetic. We do it hard, we do it tough. We just don't have any pleasure at all. That's one of the reasons, well, I think I already told you, that when I was looking for a nice place to be trained, and when I hang around a Wat Buddha Pradipa in London as a lay person, that many of the people I met there, they thought I wasn't serious because I was smiling too much. What's going on there? If you're lessening suffering, you're supposed to be smiling. Anyway, then, 25, then such wanderers might ask, well then, those who are given to these four forms of pleasure seeking, how many fruits, how many benefits can they expect? And you should reply, they can expect four fruits, four benefits, if you're addicted to the pleasure of the jhanas. Four fruits, four benefits. What are they? The first is when a monk, by the destruction of three fetters, has become a stream winner, no more subject to rebirth in lower worlds, firmly established, destined for full enlightenment. The second, when a monk, by the complete destruction of the three fetters and the reduction of greed and hatred and delusion, has become a once-returner, and having returned once more to this world, will put an end to suffering. The third is when a monk, by the complete destruction of the five lower fetters, has been spontaneously reborn, and there will reach nirvana. That's in the non-returning world, without ever returning from that world. And the fourth is when a monk or a nun, by the destruction of the corruptions in this very life, has by their own knowledge and realization attained to arahatship, to the deliverance of the heart and through wisdom. Such are the four fruits and the four benefits that one can give to these four forms. Such are the four fruits and the four benefits that one given to these four forms of pleasure seeking can expect. And I like that. I said, well, you know, if you get into the jhanas, then what can you expect? Enlightenment, freedom from suffering. The very minimum, stream winning. It's not a bad deal, is it? I thought, wow, this is really good. Anyway, so I always like to emphasize that point. And I've emphasized it enough now, so let's go on. Oh, yeah, 26. Then such wanderers might say, the doctrines of the Sakyan's followers, Buddhists, are not well founded. They should be told, "Friend, the Lord who knows and sees has taught and proclaimed to his disciples principles which are not to be transgressed as long as life shall last." Just like a locking post or an iron post which is deeply based. These are some of the things which they used to have in India in that time. And that's one of the reasons why they use these similes. But it means some deep post put down into the ground and used for many, many things. And well planted and unshakable, immovable are these doctrines he has taught. And any monk who is an arahat, whose corruptions are destroyed, who has lived the life, done what has to be done, laid down the burden, gained the true goal, who has completely destroyed the fetter of being, you've got becoming here, that's not a good translation, it's actually the fetter of being, and is liberated by supreme insight, is incapable of doing 9 things. This is what an arahat is incapable of doing. So it's one way you can find out. Who is an arahat? They are incapable of deliberately taking the life of a living being. They are incapable of taking what is not given so as to constitute theft. They are incapable of sexual intercourse. They are incapable of telling a deliberate lie. They are incapable of storing up goods for sensual indulgence as you formerly did in a household life. You are incapable of acting wrongly through attachment, incapable of acting wrongly through hatred, incapable of acting wrongly through folly, that's stupidity, or delusion, incapable of acting wrongly through fear. These are the 9 things which an arahat whose corruptions are destroyed cannot do. And, long time ago, there was a monastery over in Sri Lanka, a very good monastery, and I often mention this to the monks, that in that monastery, once you ordained there and started practicing there, you couldn't leave the monastery, not to go and visit your parents, or you could even leave to go to see the doctor or see a dentist, unless you either had the first jhana completed, so you understood what that was and had experience of it, or you were at least a stream winner. If you didn't have those basic standards in your practice, then you couldn't leave the monastery, even if you were dying and needed a doctor. And so what happened was, in this monastery, there was one of the temple attendants, the temple boy, wasn't ordained, and he was doing so well, because he's not just a temple boy, the monks would teach them, and they would also study, and they would listen to all of the Dhamma discourses, and he would also meditate. And at times that little temple boy would meditate so deeply. And the monks were just starting getting very interested in him, that he was actually doing really, really, really well. So they decided to ordain him as a novice. I'm not quite sure if he had a deep attainment first and then became a novice monk. But anyway, his practice really developed. Everyone was getting very excited. Word was going around that this was a very gifted young man. And so eventually that the teacher was confirmed, that this was a young man who was fully enlightened. So they either ordained him before, or they ordained him at that time to be a novice monk. And he was practicing very, very well until he had a very bad toothache. And he had this bad toothache, and I said, you've got jhanas, you're enlightened now, so we can arrange a dentist for you in town. So they took him into town, and when he went to see the dentist, he saw all the equipment there. He wasn't a very well-educated young man. He saw, needles for injections. Now, I don't know, when you first went to see a dentist, were you scared?
Yes.
You didn't go to the sort of dentist I went to, just as big needles and all these things with hooks on them. And this poor young novice was scared. He said, I don't want to do this. And it was that which convinced everybody, enlightened beings don't get scared. And they realized this young man was not fully enlightened. So he was already at the dentist. I think they, I don't know if they even did the dental work there. But anyway, that was what finally decided. This young man could not be a fully enlightened arahant. He still had fear. Understandable. But that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to actually to know any of those sorts of attainments of stream meaning, whilst returning, non-returning, or arahat. And often people ask me about those sorts of states and questions. And I was just reminded with a discussion I had earlier with somebody, I often say that if a person has a very deep and powerful attainment and an experience, it's like all of your those defilements, attachments and things which you have, like they get blown up in a big explosion. And then after the explosion, there's so much dust and debris just flying around in the air. It does take a while for all that dust to settle down. And only after it settles down, you see what type of defilements have been destroyed and what type are left up there. And that's one of the reasons why if anybody does have a powerful insight, you have to wait for a while. Sometimes even for years, to see what is actually left standing and what has been demolished forever. So that's why it's sometimes hard to know. And many people, very good people, sometimes you know, have those experiences and find out, excellent, but you've still got some more work to do. Anyway, where's it going?
27.
Thank you. You know what I was going to ask. Or such wanderers might say, as regard past times, the ascetic Gotama displays boundless knowledge and insight, but not about the future. As to what it will be and how it will be, that would be to suppose that the knowledge and insight about one thing are to be produced by knowledge and insight about another something else, as fools imagine. As regard the past, the target of the Buddha, talking about himself, has knowledge of past lives. He can remember as far back as he wishes. As for the future, this knowledge, born of enlightenment, arises in him. This is his prediction for the future. This is my last birth, there will be no more being. That's a wonderful prediction. You know, cause and effect, this is going. That is, if the past refers to what is not factual, the fate to fables, to what is not of advantage, the Buddha makes no reply. If it refers to what is factual, not fabulous, but which is not of advantage, the Tathagata, the Buddha makes no reply. But if the past refers to what is factual, not a fable, and what is of benefit, then the Buddha knows the right time to reply. The same applies to the future and the present. Therefore, Chunda, the Buddha is called the one who declares the time, the fact, the advantage, the Dhamma, and the discipline. That is why he's called the Buddha. Chunda, whatever in this world, with its devas and maras and brahmas, with its ascetics and brahmins, the princes and people, is seen by people, heard, sensed, cognized, whatever was ever achieved, sought after, or mentally pondered upon, all that has been fully understood by the Buddha. That is why he's called the Buddha or Tathagata. Between the night in which the Buddha attains supreme enlightenment, Chunda, and the night in which he attains the Nibbana element without remainder, there's no five candles left. Whatever they proclaim, says or explains is so and not otherwise. That is why they're called a Tathagata. And of this world, with its devas and maras and brahmas, with its ascetics and brahmins, its princes and peoples, the Tathagata is the unvanquished conqueror, the seer and ruler of all. That is why he's called the Tathagata. I don't know why they call him a ruler, but like the chief in wisdom. All such wanderers might say, at least we get these ones, does the Buddha exist after death? Is that true or anything else? Any other view foolish? They should be told, friend, this has not been revealed by the Buddha. Does the Buddha not exist after death? Does he both exist and not exist after death? Does he neither exist nor not exist after death? They should be told, friend, this has not been revealed by the Lord. Then they may say, why has the ascetic not revealed this? They should be told, friends, this is not conducive to the welfare or to the Dhamma, or to the higher holy life, or to disenchantment, fading away, dispassion, cessation, tranquility, realization, enlightenment, nibbana. That is why the Lord has not revealed it. Or they may say, well, friend, what has the Buddha revealed? They should be told, this is suffering, this is the arising of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. Four Noble Truths. Then they may say, why has this been declared by the ascetic Gotama? They should be told, friend, this is conducive to welfare, to Dhamma, to higher holy life, to perfect disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, tranquility, to realization, to enlightenment, to nibbana. That is why it's been taught. Chunda. Those bases of speculation about the beginning of things, which I have explained to you as they should be explained, should I now explain to you as they should not be explained? And likewise about the future. What are the speculations about the past? There are ascetics and Brahmins who say and believe the soul and the world are eternal. The soul and the world are not eternal. The soul and the world are both eternal and not eternal. The soul and the world are neither eternal nor not eternal. The soul and the world are self-created. They are created by another. They are both self-created and created by another. They are neither self-created nor created by another, but have arisen by chance, and similarly with regard to pleasure and pain. Do you understand that? It's just, sometimes it gets so confused. And that's one of the reasons the Buddha never explained it. Because there's some basic faults in that. I've got time, 5 minutes here. Here we have. Because, I'll just go a little bit further. Now, Chunda, I go to those ascetics and Brahmins who hold any of these views, and if being asked, they confirm they do hold to such views, I do not admit to their claims. Why not? Because, Chunda, different beings hold different opinions on such matters. Nor do I consider such theories equal to my own, still less superior. I am the superior in regard to the higher exposition, and for those bases of speculation about the beginning of things, which I have explained to you as they should be explained, why should I now explain them to you as they should not be explained? And what about the speculations about the future? There are some ascetics and Brahmins who say the soul after death is material and healthy. Is immaterial, is both, is neither. The self is conscious after death, unconscious after death, both, neither. The soul perishes, is destroyed, ceases to be after death. This is true, another view is erroneous. Now, Chandra, I go to those ascetics and Brahmins who hold any of these views, and if being asked, they confirm that they do hold such views, I do not admit to their claims. Why not? Because, Chandra, different beings hold different opinions on such matters. Nor do I consider such theories equal to my own, still less superior. I am the superior in regard to the higher exposition. As for those bases of speculation about the future which I have explained to you, they should be explained. Why should I now explain them to you as they should not be explained? And Chunda, for the destruction of all such views about the past and the future, for transcending them, I have taught and laid down the four foundations of mindfulness. The four focuses of mindfulness is better. What are the four? Here, Chunda, monk or nun, layman, laywoman, dwells mindful of the body, experience, mind and the Dhammas, ardent, knowing the purpose and mindful, having restrained the five hindrances. That is how, Chunda, for the destruction of such views about the past and the future, and for transcending them, I have taught and laid down four foundations of mindfulness. You see what's going on here? Instead of being a philosophy, in a sense of figuring it all out and spending hour after hour after hour of thinking about the past and the future, the four focuses of mindfulness, the whole practice of Buddhism, when it's all joined together, focuses on this moment. What is life right now? What is this? And instead of actually trying to make theories when we haven't really figured out how this engine called life works, of course we get into all sorts of different views and so many arguments. And instead of doing that, what we discover if we look carefully, is to see there is nothing to get destroyed, nothing to get born. This is just what we call the process. What I said the other day, as like the tadpole and the frog. We can think and be logical about things, but then once that tadpole becomes a frog and jumps out of the water, only then can that tadpole, now a frog, fully understand the nature of water. And it's nice that the tadpole might have all these amazing discussions about what is water. Does water exist after death or not exist after death, or both exist and not exist after death, or neither exist nor not exist after death, or does it do all of these things at the same time? It can be very complicated just when we think too much. And sometimes, as a young man at university, you saw that. You know, you saw so many arguments going on, which were good fun. It's, if you regarded it just as an exercise, like a sport, where there'd be no winner but just a nice exercise, that'll be fine. But when you thought that this was the right way and other people had the wrong way, that type of conclusion just strengthened your sense of self and ego, and it never led to anything much good at all. So instead of just looking at those types of thoughts, quieten the thoughts down first of all. Listen to something. Listen much more. And that is when, instead of seeing that there's nothing or there's something, this is from the which is Kacchanagota Sutta. It's in the Samyutta Nikaya, in the Nidana Samyutta, number 12. And it became a very famous sutta because one person who became a very famous monk called Nagarjuna picked it up. And he based his whole sort of teachings on this one little sutta. He's supposed to have been a Mahayanist, but I can't see that. He was a Theravadin, simply because of this sutta is in the Samyutta Nikaya. And it teaches what we call another form of the middle way, taught by the Buddhas, no doubt about that. Not the middle way of the practice between asceticism and indulgence in the five sense pleasures, but in just the way of what is this life, and the idea of a being, a soul. And instead of just saying that no soul, or there is a soul, he said this is the third way, what he called the middle way, is causality. Something is right now, in this moment, you're causing the next moment, or this moment is the food for the next moment, and the next moment creates the next moment. It's just things arising, passing away, rising, passing away, rising, passing away, very fast. So much so that we take this to be a continuity of experience, rather than what they call that stream of consciousness. The stream, you can call it just a being, one single thing, it looks the same, but it's totally different every moment. The past moment is causing this moment, and this moment is causing the next moment. It's a process of cause and effect, like a string of beads, but with nothing passing between each bead. It's one thing causing another thing. Otherwise known, according to Buddhism, as dependent origination or dependent cessation. When you see it that way, the whole idea of, well, does this, is there a soul which continues after death, of an arahat, of an enlightened being? Is there nothing after death? Is it all destroyed? There's no destruction, it's just the process stops. Once the oil in the wick and the heat disappears, it's all used up, then the flame goes out. It doesn't get destroyed, it doesn't continue on. To make the point, I sometimes wondered whether if a flame has been a very good flame and cooked your lunch for you, because of its goodness, will it go to the heaven where flames live happily ever after and don't have to wonder about, do we sort of exist forever or what? And sometimes if you've been a bad flame and you burnt the porridge, Then do you go to the hell where all flames, they burn far hotter than they can stand? Of course, that's ridiculous, isn't it? Just a flame, that's all. Just the five khandhas. Just body and mind doing its thing. And then it stops. It doesn't get destroyed. The causes for keeping it going end. It doesn't go anywhere. It's just a process which has now come to its final cessation. During this time, the Venerable Upavana was standing behind the Lord, fanning him. And he said, because in those days we didn't have aircon, and said, "It is wonderful, Lord, it is marvellous, Lord. This exposition of Dhamma is delightful, highly delightful. What is the name of this discourse?" Well, Upavana, you can remember it as the delightful discourse. Thus the Lord spoke, and the Venerable Upavana rejoiced and was delighted with his words. So that was the delightful discourse. And especially the easy part to understand, and I often quote this just so you hear the whole thing, just to know that if you really get into the meditations and the jhanas, nothing bad's going to happen to you except you're going to get enlightened. Do you want to get enlightened? Well, there it is, you get attached to the jhanas and it just happens. You don't do it. It happens automatically. Any other questions before we finish? Yes.
Is that possible that if you have like two highly realized teacher and they don't agree on some certain thing, for example, what's the definition of jhana, vipassana, etc.? Is it possible or?
No, not really. They won't argue.
Okay.
Instead of arguing, if we do meet. Some years ago, sometimes on conferences, I love going to conferences in that time of my life when I was young, fit, healthy, but you know, had a lot of experience in meditation. I remember going to see this, he was a Vajrayana monk, this Tibetan tradition, a monk. There's many types of Vajrayana Buddhism. Some are not celibate and they wear the robes during the day and they go back home at night time. 9-to-6 job, 9-to-5 job. I thought there was something wrong with that, but I didn't have any faith in that. But this other traditions was excellent. And so this monk, which is having half an hour, when there's nothing going on in the conference, that's what I like conference, because you weren't always teaching all the time. You could make some new contacts and discuss things. And because, you know, we were both disciples of the Buddha, monks, it was easy to chat. And so we started talking about deep meditation. And of course, had different names for it, but then after a while, I said, "Hey, you know that thing," he called it Mahamudra. And I don't know this sort of the words in the Vajrayana tradition. I said, "Hey, that's the first jhana." And he sort of talked deeply to him to make sure that he knows what he's talking about. And he talked to me. And so after a while, and it was wonderful. Different names, but when you talk properly to one another, you get all the same ideas. Yeah, that's right. That's what it is. So if two people are highly realized, if they really are highly realized, they don't argue. Because jhana is just jhana. You realize the same thing, of course, you explain the same thing. Sometimes you've got to wait for a little while to make sure you understand each other and understand the language you're saying, because that can be sometimes difficult. Or you usually sometimes experience, you chat with somebody and they haven't achieved the jhanas at all. Or it's what sometimes they call these days jhana light. L-I-T-E. In other words, it's not the real thing. But well, it's close enough. It's not the real thing. But if anyone's experienced these things, they know what the real thing is. And also, you don't go around just making it sort of a part of your personal achievements. They're impersonal. It's just what happens when you start to disappear and fade away, when you vanish. So how can you claim them as being your personal achievements? Makes no sense. So that's why you don't argue. Yeah?
Did any Arahant children born again,
they know what the choice is, what the will is. They have got no choice. They just can't. It's impossible. Can a palm tree with the crown cut off just get reborn again or grow again? You can't do that. It's impossible. So, why? You're letting everybody down, you can't get reborn again. That's not how it works in the Buddhism. A person like a Buddha doesn't get reborn again, but teaches, inspires, lays down the ground so more people can practice and more people can become arahats. And then, when more people become arahats, you don't need a Buddha. You've got the other arahats to do the work. But quite frankly, if you were really, really sick and needed, say, a heart operation, would you always want the first person who ever did heart operations, because they did the best heart operations years ago? But those people who do the heart operations, they teach other students how to do it. So that after a while, that those other students even become better than the first heart surgeon. And so those students, when they start to get old, they can teach others, and then they retire. You can't have a person being a heart surgeon forever. So it's the same with monks and nuns. Great nuns become fully enlightened. They don't just disappear then. They have this wonderful time when they teach others, and they really know what they're talking about. And those enlightened bhikkhunis, they teach, and they create so many more enlightened bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. And it's, when it comes to those sorts of teachings, it doesn't matter what gender you are. That's actually how it works. Sometimes I have the image of turning the wheel of Dhamma. So the Buddha got the wheel going. And then other people, when the Buddha passed away, other people take over and they push the wheel. And then other people take over and push the wheel. That's amazing, just after all these centuries. That was sometimes really amazes me when I stop and contemplate it. After 25 centuries, you know, in a little valley in India, you know, these monks and nuns like Bhattacharya, monks like Dabha Malaputta, they also got enlightened. And it's continued all this time into so many different lands, way away from Asia, you know, to places like Western Australia. Wow, that's really cool. And it has the link there, you can see the link, the cause and effect link. All the people having faith, ordaining, becoming monks and becoming nuns, teaching, creating monasteries. It always carries on from place to place. And you don't need to argue about who's got it right, who's got it wrong. It's natural. If you've got it right, the place grows. If you've got it wrong, it doesn't grow. Any sort of bad actions soon get found out. If it's not sort of pure, it's got no energy. It's got no power to it. And people soon found out. Make any sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You notice when the Buddha had one of these dreams, he dreamt that he was laying on his right side. His head was facing up to the Himalayas. And he was facing the west. And people thought, that is an omen that Buddhism would eventually go to the west. And I argued, no, that's not how to interpret that omen. He was looking to the west. But you don't go to where your eyes are looking. You go to where your feet are pointing. He was pointing to Australia. I think we can finish now. Okay. Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagavad Bodhang Bhagavantam Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami. Very good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay.